Way to rouse yourself bright and early. We have some wonderful feedback already on our first day for our first time running Cancer Progress, so that was very heartening to hear. And we have a great set of talks and panels today, so hopefully we'll keep you engaged until the not bitter end when we have a great last chock-a-block panel on personalized medicine that Brian Leland Jones is going to run. So hopefully you'll stay all the way through that, as well as Mark McClellan's talk and all the other panels. And I also want to give a special thanks for a really, really excellent job and hard work that Ginny LaBelle and Karen Giardina have done at Define Health for pulling this together. Again, it's our first time running it, so please give them a hand. So before we have our morning's keynote by Ken Anderson, we're going to have kind of an opening address about kind of the world of hematology oncology by my colleague Mike Rice, who shares the oncology practice with me. I'm not going to read Mike's bio; it's in the brochure, but it's a great mix of kind of industry and entrepreneurial and academic research background, including a stint in Carlo Croce's lab. So tie everything together here. So Mike, come on up.
Thanks, Jeff. So this is my first time at Cancer Progress. Yesterday was a very, very exciting day, you know, just hearing all the different perspectives. It's a really dynamic audience with, industry representatives, physician scientists, and consultants like myself. So Jeff and the organizers have asked me to introduce Dr. Anderson, but before that, to give a brief sort of overview of what we see going on in the hematological malignancy space, since it is something many of the discussions all go around the more prevalent solid tumors. However, as you know, being a consultant, a lot of the work we do tend to be leading indicators of what's going on in the market, and the blood cancer has been a very active space over the last several years as companies look for white spaces for developing new therapies. So that said, I think everybody knows that the oncology market now is outgrowing the cardiovascular market, being the top revenue producer in the pharmaceutical industry, largely driven by the monoclonal antibodies and the small molecule cytostatics, as well as many other novel mechanisms that are also coming up from behind. Oncology is increasing in the portfolios of the top 10 pharmaceutical companies, and heme products are becoming an increasing component of that. So these are the top heme franchises according to their sales. But it's surprising because it's only, you know, less than 10% of the prevalence new incidence of malignancies, yet it generates a very large share of the overall revenue of the pharmaceutical, the oncology market, with five of the top 10 blockbuster drugs coming from small orphan diseases. So why is that? So we look in the future and we understand, you know, why is heme a very attractive space to be in? And when we look at the oncology market, it's been very attractive as resources have been reallocated from primary care markets into more specialty markets. But oncology is not immune from genericization that's going on in the overall pharma market. But when we look at that, in the mature products, what is going off patent in the next several years, we see some immunity of the blood cancer market where it seems to be much more stable through the period to come as the small molecule cytostatics and some of the tyrosine kinase inhibitors become genericized. It appears that because of a few forces that maintain exclusivity of blood cancer products that it seems to be a much more stable place to be right now. So what we see, the other area I work in is cardiovascular disease, and that is something has really changed. And what we see is that our pharma clients have really been shifting their focus from commercial risk and being much more acceptable of scientific risk, And they're looking at developing drugs for microsegments of the market, orphan diseases, using biomarker strategies to carve up patient populations that they were very reluctant to do in the past, and also being able to tap into innovative technology platforms that are able to provide therapies that, you know, really match the mechanisms of the disease. Accordingly, we see a shift from the focus on developing drugs just for the big five tumors into many small, many smaller components of the oncology market. Many of them are for blood cancers. And we see a much higher success rate of getting products for blood cancers through the clinic and into the market. And there's a much lower attrition rate for these sort of products. So from a development standpoint and from potentially a commercial standpoint, it's a very unique opportunity that we see in the market right now for developing cancer drugs. And the pipeline appears to be less shots on goal. There are less things in early development. However, they maintain and progress and make phase transitions so that there are less shots on goal being successful, presumably getting to market. Blood cancers have also been a place where they've been a leader in biologics. Many of the biologic products were first successful in the hematological malignancies before they got applied to broader therapy areas. And orphan disease status has been an advantage that has been utilized in developing products for blood cancers. There are many different advantages from development costs to exclusivity that can be maintained. And we looked at all the launches in the last several years. That there are some newer ones since this list was developed. But almost all of the heme products have been used in orphan exclusivity. Okay. Also, heme products have been sort of the poster child for biomarker development, not only through the targeted therapies, but also understanding the molecular etiology and segmentation of blood cancers. You know, just a quick example of what's going on in AML from, you know, just a classification by histology to a molecular subtype of risk factors, and now a very strong initiative in whole genome sequencing that's already providing some evidence of new prognostic markers, potentially some new therapeutic markers, and what's going on in the evolution and resistance of and recurrence of acute leukemias. And at the end of the day, when we look at the pricing of oncology products, we do see a pricing advantage for products for blood cancers, where they tend to be launched and maintain a higher pricing level versus drugs that are similarly targeted or similarly innovative inside of the solid tumor space. So what are we talking about? We're talking about a very broad range of diseases with different prognostic outcomes. And this is a very rolled up view of the heme malignancy space. You know, if you just take something like non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, according to WHO criteria, there are over, 40 different subtypes there, all each with their own unique etiologies and prognostication and treatment algorithms. So it's a very complex and segmented disease space. However, sort of one by one, we've been sort of knocking off some examples where the disease has been transformed. In case of Gleevec and CML, essentially one molecular target and one targeted therapy has completely transformed that disease and turned it from a life-threatening disease into something that's almost chronically managed now. As we heard last night at the San Giorgi Award, APL is another example where a targeted therapy has transformed the disease, somewhat in a different route to determining the target and determining, how we are actually, really changing the outcome of that disease. And We've also done by trial and error. In the case of pediatric ANL, it's just been sort of, you know, incremental advancement, trial by trial, and just, you know, following up what works best in the last trial and building upon that. So through these different approaches, we've really transformed, you know, at least these segments of hematological malignancies, yet there still remains a lot of unmet need in this market. Okay. So when we look into the pipeline, about, you know, a quarter of the products are for lymphoma, you know, the rest are for all these different other malignancies, so there's more focus on unmet need. When we look at the pipeline, we think that roughly, if we look at the incidence in comparison to the five-year overall survival and the number of agents or development projects that are in the clinic for heme malignancies, it somewhat tracks the what we see the need. And if we look at what has made a lot of these products successful, is, you know, collaboration between patient advocacy from you know, thought leaders in the area, physician scientists that are running the clinical trials, the industry partners, the payers, even sort of all the stakeholders in healthcare have come together to really promote. These are a couple examples of philanthropic investment into bridging translational gaps in, for heme malignancies. LLS has been very proactive in this space and has been targeting investment into therapies or mechanisms that they think have identified have you know, great promise to address significant unmet need in the patients that they represent. They have developed somewhat of a virtual drug pipeline that is not unlike a mid-cap, large-cap biotech company. Multiple Myeloma Research Foundation has also been very proactive in this space, focusing on one disease, whereas the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society is looking much more broadly across the heme malignancy space. So that said, there's been significant deal activity in the heme space. You know, after a little bit of a lull in deal activity last year, in 2010, last year seemed to be on the upswing, and actually deal values had increased, even though the upfront payments have been a little bit lower and the deals have been a little bit more backloaded. But oncology has led the area for deal making, both in number and in size of deals over the last several years. Okay, so just to highlight a few of the deals that we've looked at, and I know that Dr. Anderson might touch on a few of these programs, but when we look across the space, there's been very significant creative deals going on, but when we look at what they're focused on, so there are many things that are focused on T-cell lymphomas and myeloma, which again emphasize the unmet need and the opportunity in their spaces, even though they've become somewhat more crowded spaces, given the success of introducing new therapies in those spaces. There's still a significant need. And in the case of myeloma, we can even sort of consider it as sort of a platform for getting drugs approved. And the challenge then is, you know, how do you then position yourself in the treatment algorithm and expand your market from there? But, you know, it seems to be a good, pretty good platform for validating new mechanisms and getting drugs approved. Okay. So that said, so I just wanted to introduce Dr. Ken Anderson. He's been a driving force in myeloma in particular, and just wanted to share some of our thoughts about this today and hopefully build on and give a little bit more detail what I said. So.
Yeah, thank you very much, and it really is an honor to be here. I do want to congratulate the organizers because I think the composition of the folks that are here and the Foundation for Cancer Research, but each of us represents our own constituencies, part of a team that absolutely has to work together, whether you want to call it the New York Giants or, as I would, the New England Patriots. Wait till next year, is all I can tell you. But we all need to work together because we need to somehow make this process more efficient, both in terms of time and resources, because quite frankly, the patients are counting on us to do that. So I was asked to talk about myeloma, which is my favorite disease, and I will do that, but I'm going to use this as an example of how I hope several different ways could be illustrated where we could work together better no matter what disease context we're working in. So I've been very lucky to be funded with what's called a SPOR grant, a special program in oncology research and education, which is a grant from our federal government that insists that a program translates to the benefit, diagnosis, prognosis, or treatment of patients within 5 years of its funding, and as its other component, trains the next generation of researchers. And the reason I tell you this is that this slide sort of depicts the traditional fragmented approach that we all have to trying to get new drugs developed. And we each have our roles as are depicted on this slide. But I think it's becoming much more of a continuum. And we need to honestly exploit the abilities, for example, that discovery abilities that are illustrated at this meeting with genomics, et cetera, in academia, with the abilities in industry to commercialize and develop drugs, and then those of us, again, who are doing the clinical trials. It needs to be much more seamless if we're actually going to succeed. And here's the team that I think, and it's like the Olympics for a reason, but the five people, five constituents here working together, honestly, are the reasons drug gets developed quickly. And I'll illustrate for you why it is that myeloma has been very blessed to have a few diseases, few new agents go from the bench to the bedside in short order, but it is because of a collaboration of these five constituencies. Now, at our center, and the reason we partner, in fact, with many of you in this room, is that we actually are focused on myeloma. We have a large practice in and of ourselves, but we also leverage our resources, just like all of you do in your various contexts. So we have preclinical studies and clinical trials with correlative science nationally and internationally, company and outside of company collaborations. We're funded by a variety of sources, the government, private foundations, industry in a major way. But not to be underestimated is the willingness in America for people, philanthropy, to support cancer research. It's really been a quite extraordinary blessing. And I would just stress, and Bob Vass and others know this, but the funding level right now from our National Cancer Institute is at the 7th percentile. That means 93% of grants don't get funded. And even within that 7th percentile, there's some selection of what grants should actually be funded. So truthfully, it's a crisis situation. And we really do need to leverage, is what I'm trying to stress here, all the sources we possibly can if we're going to keep the progress going that is illustrated at this meeting. So in terms of myeloma as a model for collaboration, I would just mention we have been blessed because we collaborate, as has been illustrated here in several sessions, in our genomics area, with the Broad, with the Sanger Center, et cetera. But we have now the ability in academia, which I would stress, not only to identify targets, to validate them in model systems, but we have synthetic chemistry now, so we can make prototype inhibitors that can more rapidly be translated to small biotechs and pharma and to the bedside than ever before. And I'll give you an example of that in a minute. This was already mentioned, the Leukemia Lymphoma Society, but they're actually sponsoring new drug development, an extraordinarily forward-thinking program, which is really helping to get targeted therapies to patients faster. We have within our center the ability to make monoclonal antibodies that can then go out into industry. We work to make genetic models of mice in our case of myeloma in our case with a consortium at the National Cancer Institute. We have a vaccine center. We work together with other diseases. Why? Because as is illustrated at this meeting, the mechanisms, the pathways, the inhibitors are going to be useful in a variety of situations. You heard yesterday about the melanoma V600E mutation. It's been described in a variety of diseases. For example, it's universally expressed in hairy cell leukemia. The point is we can not always anticipate some of these surprises, but we work together and try to learn from the pathways and the inhibitors that we develop in different diseases. The consortium was mentioned. Was one of the founding members of a preclinical and clinical collaboration of centers of excellence in myeloma that can fast forward the preclinical testing and validation as well as the clinical trials. And then, honestly, I'm very, very passionate about making sure the advances that we all have get to our patients. So how does that happen? It happens in phase three clinical trials. As many of you know, there's been a reorganization in the United States of cooperative groups to try to make them more efficient. The National Cancer Institute has steering committees for each disease, trying to prioritize what actually gets to the World Series or the Super Bowl or phase three clinical trials. I and others have been very active in the NCCN guidelines. Why is that important? Because when we in this room together get a drug approved, it doesn't matter, in my opinion, unless it's access for the appropriate populations. And NCCN is only one agency, but it is one agency which has actually had medical input into the indications for different disease therapeutic options. Paradigms for treatment have been written, and now they've been adopted by CMS and many of the third-party payers for reimbursement. So that's been wonderful. And then we work at an international level because the world is a small place in order to fast-forward progress. So why do I tell you all that? Well, in myeloma, as many of you know, we've been blessed. We have an ability to make models of myeloma in the microenvironment. We can easily get bone marrow, and we can show that the myeloma cell in the bone marrow microenvironment actually has growth, survival, and drug resistance mechanisms that are different when it is studied alone. That observation actually allows you to screen for mechanisms that can overcome that advantage, which we and others have done for many years and found proteasome inhibitors and immunomodulatory drugs as the first classes of drugs that can do this. Rapidly, it went to clinical trials and far advanced disease, as you know, relapse disease, upfront consolidation and maintenance. And what's happened? What's happened is the median survival, because of all of us working together, is at least doubled from 3 to 4 to 6 to 7 years. And if you add maintenance to this, which you should do because it's now validated, there will be 3 papers in a famous journal from New England pretty soon to document that. But in any event, when I see new patients in the clinic, which I do so frequently, I can actually look them in the eye and tell them, you know, you're going to live probably 10 years. And that's extraordinary. Not too long ago, their survival was very, very, very short indeed. So it really does a testament to the modeling systems, to the ability of translate, which is key for all of us, and then the ability to get out there and have patients have access to the drugs. So here's one of the examples that you know well. The proteasome inhibitor, okay, in the year 2000, it was shown to target tumor cells and kill them in the microenvironment at a time when alkylating agents, anthracycline, steroids, radiation, nothing else was working. This was qualitatively different. It was a eureka moment. At the same time, the phase 1-2 clinical trials, the first patient treated was going to hospice, got treated with this drug, and had a complete response. So it wasn't a subtle, you didn't have to look for a p-value or anything. It was obvious. Okay, but the point here is then those 5 constituencies started working together. Academia, NCI, the regulators, and I do want to put in a positive word about the FDA. You probably won't like that, but I do think they're very proactive at helping in terms of learning about the disease, and if the agent is active, really trying to help get it approved, along with, obviously, pharma and biotech, and most importantly, last but not least, the patients. But this drug got approved in about 2.5 years, and advanced disease accelerated 2 years later for relapse, and now it's approved as initial therapy. So what's the big deal? Well, what happened as we went forward is we learned much more about this drug together by doing correlative science. We learned, in fact, that here's the drug Velcade in the middle, and we had known that it attacks the proteasome sure enough. But in in vitro models and now in clinical samples from patients on clinical trials, you can show different mechanisms by which it works. This is a new cartoon, but it directly induces apoptosis, stress response, acts on the cell cycle, inhibits growth and survival. It attacks NF-kappa B, which is one of the original premises, and it induces ER stress. But what's also important, it, long after it was approved, it was appreciated in the laboratory and the clinic that it actually has effects in the microenvironment. Very important. You need to study the tumor in the microenvironment in the models and preclinical studies because it's in the microenvironment in the patients that we treat. So this drug has anti-angiogenesis characteristics, but from a clinical point of view in myeloma, it actually inhibits osteoclasts and bone breakdown, and it stimulates new bone formation. And many of you don't know maybe myeloma, but that's the main problem our patients have that causes pain and limits quality of life. So an advantage that wasn't appreciated early, but again, the context of the tumor and the microenvironment. Now, if those of you went to ASH in San Diego in December may have seen this, but Jesus San Miguel presented a 5-year follow-up of the first bortezomib trial that was the one called VISTA that resulted in approval for newly diagnosed patients. What's the big deal? The big deal is when you target the tumor in the microenvironment, here's what happens when I and many others, pretty much everybody now with my who takes care of myeloma patients, use Velcade as the initial treatment. Patients live over a year longer. That's a huge advantage with long-term follow-up. This is real objective data. So it's very, very exciting time indeed. You know the other class of drugs, the immunomodulatory drugs, are shown here. Some of you know this, and I'll say it since it's early in the morning, but I'm called the Mr. Rogers of cancer because I like to target the tumor in the microenvironment. I go around singing It's a Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, wear sweaters, slippers, and am demented, okay? But in any event, want to get the day off to a roll here. So, but anyway, the IMIDs are thalidomide, lenalidomide, and pomalidomide, but why were they qualitatively different? They had their direct effects in terms of caspase-8-mediated apoptosis, but they acted by inhibiting the binding, inhibiting the constitutive and the myeloma cell binding-induced transcription and secretion of cytokines, inhibiting angiogenesis, and these drugs are called IMIDs or immunomodulatory drugs because they upregulate in patients T cells, NK cells, and NKT cells that mediate anti-myeloma activity. And the reason I just start with this quickly is the same deal. Just as with the proteasome inhibitor, the preclinical studies were in the year 2000. We have approval here because of the five constituencies working together in relapse disease, and we have very positive data up front and as maintenance that I alluded to before. So this has clearly transformed myeloma therapy. So that's what's happened so far, but I want to try to just pick a few examples of what I think are more promising developments for the future. Yes, we have a survival now in the maybe around a decade, but few, if any, patients are cured. So we still need to work together and try to come up with next generation targets or new approaches. So I'm going to divide it into four areas very quickly: immune treatments, novel agents. How can we be smarter about picking the right teams of drugs? I'm sure you heard about this a little yesterday with the VRAF 600E mutation doesn't work the same in different contexts. It's going to need to be a partner. Doesn't work at all in colon cancer. Works pretty good in melanoma. There are pathways and combinations that we're going to have to use in different contexts. And then I'll comment here in myeloma, just a few comments about personalized medicine, about which you'll hear a lot later in this meeting. And here's my prediction that myeloma will be a chronic illness with a substantial, sustained complete response and a significant fraction. I would tell you that I did predict that the Patriots would win the Super Bowl as well. But in any event, so in terms of the immune, they will next year. The immune therapies that have been tried in myeloma are shown on this particular slide. We've been trying for a long time. We're very jealous of our lymphoma and CLL colleagues. But we've tried a number of antibodies that mediate ADCC, CDC, and are very either agonist or antagonist to growth and survival or directly triggering apoptotic signaling. I'm not going to talk about these in any extent except show you one example, which I think is very special. You know, when you think about bench to bedside or translational research, we always think about starting in the lab and go into the clinic. But what this slide illustrates is really the iterative process going back and forth that I think is so critical and can only happen if we in this room work together. So here's the situation. In myeloma, there's an antigen called CS1 that we and others found at a gene and a protein level universally expressed in myeloma patient samples at the bedside. That went back to the laboratory, and it was shown in our group and others that elotuzumab, a humanized antibody, could mediate ADCC directed at this antigen on myeloma cells in the lab in animal models, a variety of mechanisms of killing. That preclinical data then went back to the clinic, so back to the bedside, for a trial of the antibody as a single agent. And many of you may know, but it achieved stable disease in patients whose myeloma was growing, so that was a victory, if you will. But it did not warrant new drug development because we didn't see any responses. As I don't have to tell you, that's usually the end of the story. But it wasn't, fortunately, the end of the story this time because it went back from the clinic into the laboratory where in our group it was shown that lenalidomide added to this antibody markedly upregulated ADCC. Huge upregulation, went back into the clinic, and now the response when you combine lenalidomide with the antibody was 80 to 90% response. So as we're sitting here this morning, there are phase 3 trials ongoing, relapse myeloma, lenalidomide dex versus lenalidomide dex elotuzumab, hopefully for new drug approval. But the point is it would have never even been considered if it weren't for this iterative process of bedside to bench and back, which I think is so critical, and it's another manifestation of how we need to work together as a team to expedite progress. Now, in terms of immune therapies in myeloma, we too have vaccines, and I'm going to mention quickly to them two examples. We have a vaccine against the entire myeloma cell. We're fusing myeloma cells to dendritic cells. Remember, myeloma cells are good fusion partners. That's how monoclonal antibodies are made, with murine myeloma cells. And in this example, in mice and in men, you can immunize patients against their entire immune myeloma cell, and you can demonstrate immune responses. And in far advanced myeloma so far, we have at least stable disease in a significant fraction of patients. So that's against the entire myeloma cell. We also have a program where we have personalized medicine, if you will, in vaccines for myeloma. And here's the situation. You all know very much about peptide vaccines and all the history, the long history, mostly frustrating. But here the issue is we validated some targets. CD138 is universally expressed. CS1 I've already mentioned. I didn't mention the transcription fraction XBP1, which is in fact responsible for normal B cells to go to plasma cells. But the concept here is these are the targets, but the peptides that are chosen from those targets are predicated upon the ability of the host to respond. And so you literally use cocktails of peptides, but in fact different in different HLA contexts. So personalized medicine, if you will, because the targets are validated, defined genetically and validated, but in fact are personalized because the way they're presented is actually different in different patient populations. Now, moving on in terms of the next generation of targeted therapies, I just want to mention my favorite target, which is protein homeostasis or catabolism. I know that's the favorite target for others in this room as well. But here's my favorite garbage disposal called the proteasome here. And in fact, you can target the proteasome with a variety of inhibitors that are either selective or not. But there, and I won't be have time in the interest here to mention this, but we have upstream inhibitors of deubiquitinating enzymes. You need to deubiquitinate the protein in order for it to bind to the 20S core of the proteasome and be degraded. We have inhibitors there. And we have inhibitors after the proteasome. But I'll just focus on the ones that have made it to the clinic so far in terms of second generation. The first one was carfilzomib. It's a chymotryptic inhibitor, irreversible. The depth and duration of inhibition of the chymotryptic activity is longer than bortezomib. In animals and in man, it has little in the way of neurotoxicity, and in fact, it has very little. It has a lot of activity. In advanced disease and in relapse disease, and in fact, there are ongoing trials now. Actually now completed, of carfilzomib lenalidomide dex versus lenalidomide dex phase 3 for new drug approval. So a chymotryptic inhibitor that's irreversible because of a covalent bond. In myeloma and other cancers, I think the future is honestly oral therapies, and we're blessed because we have an oral chymotryptic inhibitor coming into the clinic already. It's called MLN-9708. Here's in a human myeloma growing in a mouse, treated with bortezomib in the red line here, treated with this oral inhibitor. The mouse is cured. This is a tunnel assay, and Caspase-3 activation in the tumor, human tumor in the mouse treated, showing that you have apoptosis. Presented at ASH, there are clinical trials that are showing activity in far advanced disease, and when you combine it with lenalidomide, dexamethasone in the early treatment, very high response rates. There's also more broad inhibitors of the proteasome, one called merizumib that blocks the chymotryptic, tryptic, and caspase sites of the proteasome. Why do I show this? Because if you look at all patients or patients whose myeloma is resistant to bortezomib or refractory to lenalidomide, we have response rates in all categories. And as we stand here this morning, it isn't clear what is the extent of inhibition of the proteasome or how broadly do you need to inhibit the proteasome for optimal clinical benefit. So very, very exciting bench-to-bedside research happening here. Now there's new IMiDs that many of you know about. The new lenalidomide is called pomalidomide. That's already made it to clinical trials. This is one trial, multi-center in the United States, presented at ASH. The response rates are about 30 to 35%, including in myeloma that's refractory to lenalidomide and bortezomib. The same thing is true in France. This was presented at ASH as well. But we have response rates in the range of 30 to 40% here with a large fraction of other patients with stable disease, even in the context of response to no other therapies. And the Mayo Clinic has also repeated this, but if you just look at this one bar, this is in patients whose myeloma has the nerve to be resistant to bortezomib and lenalidomide. We're dealing with about a 40% response rate here. It's an oral agent, and it's very well tolerated. So we have new proteasome inhibitors, and we have new IMiDs. I just made a couple of slides because here are some of the other new drugs that I'm really not going to spend much time on. Proteasome inhibitor IMiDs, we mentioned already elotuzumab, but there are other antibodies, immunotoxins. I'll mention AKT and HDAC inhibitors in a minute. In terms of novel classes of targeted therapies, we have this targeting the spindle here, inhibitor from Array. We have CDK inhibitors, hedgehog inhibitors, mTOR inhibitors. I'll talk a little bit about agrisome and autophagy as a target, and we have MEK inhibitors that have all made it from the bench to the bedside in myeloma, among others. But here's an amazing slide. These are the phase 3 clinical trials that are currently ongoing in myeloma. There didn't used to be any, okay? Now there's 7 trials ongoing. It's remarkable. And you will see, we've already talked about carfilzomib and pomalidomide. We've talked about elotuzumab. I'll talk about these. But some of them, at least 2 or 3 of them, are going to get approved, if not more. So that gets me to the third part, which is this. How are we going to improve upon the success rate of clinical trials no matter what cancers we treat? Well, in myeloma, we've tried to use model systems that inform the design of clinical trials. A couple of quick examples. Here's an example of Velcade inducing death of myeloma, caspase-mediated apoptosis, but activating AKT. In contrast, if you add parafosine to AKT here and block this survival signal, you get synergistic killing in the laboratory and also in animal models. So this observation went from the bench to the bedside, and this is the phase 1-2 clinical trial. But what it shows is that 41% of people responded with a survival of over 2 years, including myeloma that's refractory or sensitive or not to bortezomib. If you add in an AKT inhibitor, parafosine, to block the activation of AKT in patients triggered by bortezomib. So informed by the science, we have response rates here, and as a consequence, we have a phase 3 clinical trial ongoing around the world of parafosine and bortezomib versus bortezomib in relapsed myeloma. Now, this is the most exciting, I believe, example or target, at least in my view, which is protein homeostasis in myeloma, a disease of excess protein. You can block with the proteasome, as we've discussed extensively, first and second generation proteasome inhibitors. But there's another pathway here, the agrisome autophagy pathway, that can be blocked by blocking with HDAC inhibitors, which block the ability of the ubiquitinated protein to bind to the dynein motility complex and shuttle the protein to the agrisome. You can do it with broad HDAC inhibitors or selective HDAC6 inhibitors. Well, the broad inhibitors have gone from the bench to the bedside. If you were asked, you saw the phase 3 clinical trial of vorinostat blocking the agrosome, a broad HDAC inhibitor, added to bortezomib, blocking the proteasome to block both pathways. What happened? In a phase 3 trial, the combination had a very statistically significant increase, 54 versus 41% response rate. In fact, it did meet its endpoint in terms of a hazard ratio. The problem is the PFS advantage was only 1 month. How come? The science is impeccable. What happened? The trouble is the broad-acting HDAC inhibitors have too many side effects. I put in the yellow here, the heme and non-hematologic side effects honestly precluded patients from taking this active combination. They were coming off the trial even though they were responding. So we have a very exciting story. Histone deacetylase 6 is the one that you want to inhibit selectively if you could. There wasn't an available agent, so synthetic chemistry at our institution in the fall of 2009 made a prototype inhibitor. Here it is. It inhibits the deacetylation of tubulin, so increasing acetylation of tubulin is what we measure. It doesn't have much activity on histones at all. Here's adding in the rightmost lanes on this slide. This is adding in the HDAC inhibitor and the proteasome inhibitor. You get massive accumulation of ubiquitinated protein because you're blocking both pathways, and you get synergistic myeloma cell death. The reason I tell you that is this was made in the fall of 2009 in academia, can you imagine? And in fact, it went quickly to a small angel investor supported biotech with the help of the TAP program from the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, but this drug went from the bench to the bedside in about 18 months at a reasonable cost. It's going full blast now in its third cohort of the phase 1-2 trial and being very well tolerated with patients on it as long as 8 cycles so far. But it's one example of how potentially we can partner better academia and those of you in biotech and pharma to expedite things. Why is it so important? Do you need to use science to inform things? If you combine lenalidomide, which it triggers caspase-mediated apoptosis, with bortezomib, which is primarily caspase-9-mediated apoptosis, in the laboratory it's hugely synergistic. In the clinic, if you combine the two, even in patients whose myeloma is resistant to lenalidomide or bortezomib, if you put the combination together, 60% of people respond. It's a big deal for our patients. If you use that combination, lenalidomide, bortezomib, dexamethasone up front, everybody responds 100%. Three-quarters get a very good partial, and half of the patients get a complete, including molecular complete responses. So exciting, in fact, that we have what I call the Franco-American spaghetti trial, which is right here. But this is an IFM, that's the French myeloma group and our group, working together, 80 sites in France, 15 medical centers in the United States, 100 patients. They get this active combination because it's universal frequency of response. They all get stem cells collected, and the standard process is to get a stem cell transplant, which occurs in half the patients. But because of this exciting extent and frequency of response, half of the patients don't get the stem cell transplant. We may be able to change the paradigm of treatment because of using science-based, informed combination of targeted therapies. We have actually incredible science going on here with whole genome sequencing, for example, of all patients at the time of diagnosis and relapse. And we have a lot of science, a new PO1, in fact, generated to figure out heterogeneity of myeloma, mechanisms of sensitivity and resistance, et cetera. Now, I'm going to finish with just a couple of slides about having talked about the history tumor in the microenvironment, the immune therapies, second-generation drugs and combinations, just a few thoughts about personalized medicine in myeloma. We in myeloma have been looking with classic cytogenetics for a long time. Every new patient gets them, and we've been able to define who has standard or high-risk myeloma predicated upon conventional or high-dose therapies. But the reason I stress that and the reason it's so key to do what we're doing together in all the diseases is new therapies have actually got new factors. So bortezomib that I've talked to you about does not respect the previous high risk or standard risk categories. It actually overcomes some of the adverse genetic features. However, certain of them, such as 17p deletion, still is a problem in multiple myeloma. It's a killer.
Now, in myeloma, as some of you know, we work together right from the start with novel agents to figure out who responds and who doesn't. In the very first trial of bortezomib, here's transcripts that were present in the responders, transcripts that were present in those who didn't respond, and there are now signatures. For example, the NF-kappa-B, primarily non-canonical pathway activation, does predict for sensitivity to bortezomib. We've also gotten together and we've tried to classify our patients with myeloma. Here are universally treated patients who do better or not, predicated upon a 70-gene model in Arkansas or a 15-gene model in France. The trouble is we don't have a universal system yet in the world for, I don't know what's going on here, in the world for predicting based on profiling prognostic output. We've also looked at a DNA-based program. Here's SNP array showing that extra chromosome copies of 1Q, 5Q, and decreased copy number of 12P in universally treated patients has a different outcome. So we're looking also at the DNA level. We, in our center, as in others, are using, in fact, this analysis together with the Broad and Sang Sanger to identify new targets as well. So here's the SNP array here, array CGH actually, showing extra copy number or amplicons here. We look at the genes and we see which ones are transcribed, but we have the ability now with overexpression or knockdown systems in our microenvironment to see which is important and which is not. And there's a couple of examples I want to share with you from this year. Completely novel ideas, I hope, that are going to translate. One is the bromodomains, of which undoubtedly you know a lot, regulating, chromatin modification. In our studies, in fact, bromodomain number 4 in particular was really implicated. Why? Because, in fact, it regulates MYC expression, as is shown here. In academia, an inhibitor was made, which has marked activity against myeloma cells in the laboratory and in animals. And as you know, many companies are actively pursuing bromodomains, which were genomically identified in myeloma in our context. And the other one is the BTK inhibitors, which you know all about in lymphomas and in CLL, but you may not know about them in myeloma. But they were also identified genomically and validated in the microenvironment to have effects against tumor, but also they actually inhibit osteoclast activation. And as I mentioned earlier, that's an important thing in myeloma. My final concepts are these. We also need to do whole genome sequencing, as you've heard about and we'll hear more about, and we have done it in myeloma for the first time in 19 patients with newly diagnosed and 19 in relapse. And we found mutations in protein homeostasis, NF-kappa-B, interferon regulatory factor 4, and BLIMP1, which are necessary for normal plasma cells. Not surprisingly, histone methylation. But we did find the VRAF mutations 4% of the time in our cancer as well, the same mutation, V600E. And I always make this joke, but I've been referred over the years a lot of cases of malignant melanoma, people thinking that I'm a skin doctor, but I'm actually multiple myeloma, bone marrow cancer, but maybe there's more in common than we appreciated. The final thought I have, and I think it will come out more and more at this meeting, is we are dealing with a very complex situation because it's, at least in our program, we're trying to integrate the various levels of analysis when we do personalized medicine from a DNA, RNA, splice RNA, microRNA, all the way up to and including protein mutations at different points in time. And I'll just give you one example. This is from our big study that I shared with you, our 1,000-patient trial with France. But this is, it shows you right here on the left-hand side. These are mutations that were present in late tumors that weren't there earlier. If you look at it in the upper right-hand corner here, just right here, I guess, for the interest of time, but there's mutations that are acquired, there's mutations that go away, and there's mutations that remain in early and late tumor. Here are copy number changes, decreased copy number changes here in late tumor that weren't there earlier. And then there's changes here such as translocations that were present early that aren't there late. My point is that we're going to need to look over time. It's not surprising when cancer relapses that the genetic program has changed. People need to appreciate how complicated this is going to be, not only looking at patients, but looking at a given point in time. So what I try to do very quickly is a little bit about immune therapy, a little bit about the second generation agents that we know about, a little bit about forming the right teams, and then a very quick thing about genomics and myeloma. My own team is shown here. As many of you know, I call it the United Nations Against Myeloma, the laboratory, going to the clinic, bench to bedside and back. And, you know, it just reminds me to say that it's such a privilege. We all work together, and we try to do the right thing for patients. It doesn't get any better. But the other side of this is that many of these people and their predecessors have now gone on to be leaders in America and around the world. So we're still collaborating, and we have long-term friendships while helping patients. And it's really an extraordinary privilege to be able to do this. Thanks ever so much. Yes.
That was a great talk. Thank you very much. My question is on the 17p deletion over here.
Okay, thank you.
I'm a ventriloquist. In the 17p deletions, is there often one p53 allele that's intact, do you know? I'm wondering if this lends itself to HDM2 inhibition.
It does. It does. Well, I should let Carlo talk on this too, but I think that there are patients, in fact, if you look very carefully, even in the early patients, there can be, in a fraction of the patient's myeloma early on, P53 deletion. It turns out Rafael Fonseca and other people have correlated the frequency of the deletion with the prognostic implications. There are several ways of potentially attacking the abnormality in multiple myeloma. That range all the way from what you're talking about, potentially MDM2, to the immune therapies that I'm talking about, which theoretically should be able to kill myeloma cells regardless of what's going on genomically, to downstream PARP inhibitors and other things that are using breast cancer, but trying to come up with novel therapies that may not depend on a normal, P53 function. But we clearly need to do something else. Everybody, even the patients who don't present with P17 deletion, everybody over time, when you do these sequential genomic studies, everybody becomes P53 deficient. And when that happens, it's a very sad situation. It's virtually untreatable.
Ken, phenomenal progress in talk. Thank you. Just wondered if you had any opinions about MGUS and any progress with this disease that can be asymptomatic and people die with a monoclonal peak. Without disease, and whether there's any thoughts or about interventions or definition of the disease that could stratify risk?
Yeah, that's a super question. Thank you for it. And yes, there is. We have in myeloma an experiment of nature that I'll just mention for everybody, that MGUS have a protein in the serum but no other features of myeloma. That progresses to an intermediate phase called smoldering myeloma, 8 to 10 years without a need for therapy, and then eventually to active myeloma. So if we had a way of intervening early, and in particular identifying those who progress, that would be terrific. Now, there are ways to identify who's going to progress, such as the amount and type of the protein, the kappa-lambda ratio, et cetera. My friend Jesus San Miguel in France has used, in Spain, has used the multicolor flow cytometry. But in any event, you can predict who has high risk, in particular smoldering myeloma, who's destined to progress to active disease in 18 months. And already we have a trial of lenalidomide that was presented at ASH to try to prevent that progression. And 41% of patients progressed in the control arm, and nobody progressed in the lenalidomide-treated arm. There are vaccines coming. There are CARE antibodies coming, Ohio and other places. There are a variety of ways now that are being employed to try to treat early and prevent the progression towards active disease. And I think that's a very exciting development.
Over here.
Yes.
Brian Nicaro from Medco. So as a payer where I sit, if all the drugs that are currently in phase 3, if half of those make it, to the clinic and get approved, how as a physician are you going to decide which drugs to actually treat, what scheduling to do, which one's the right drug for you and for the patient?
Yeah. No, that I hear you loud and clear, and it's the most happy problem, I want you to know. Because everything that I've shared with you this morning, if you put the active classes of drugs, you can put them on one hand, okay?
because I talked to you about new proteasome inhibitors. I talked to you about new IMIDs. I'm very into helping those get to patients as quickly as possible. But we were talking earlier with a couple of folks. We need completely new classes of drug outside the box, novel ways of inhibiting P53 or restoring P53 function, new ways that are going to make a difference. Why we're so excited about monoclonal antibodies or an immune approach is we don't have one. But to answer your question directly, we are trying all the time to put patients on clinical protocols. An IMID plus a proteasome inhibitor, as I tried to convince you, if you or anybody of your family had myeloma, you would want to go on that combination because you have a 100% chance of responding, et cetera. But it's not good enough. I didn't tell you this morning, but if you add an HDAC inhibitor to that, you not only get universal responses, you get an increased extent of response. Who knows what would happen if you added an antibody? My hope is that if we get in myeloma, we might get where our colleagues have in lymphoma. So a majority of patients maybe, or a significant fraction, might respond to CHOP Rituxan or now bendamustine Rituxan. But we needed to form our team. I'm very cognizant, though, that I think there's going to be subsets of myeloma that are going to require very special interventions in that setting. But the answer is we have all patients now get some IMID or a proteasome inhibitor. Steroids, yes. Steroids, I'm not sure, are going to be long-term because they're the least favorite medicines our patients take. Novel classes are coming. I believe strong in HDAC and an antibody are going to be the next two members of our team.
To go ahead and get started here. Yeah. Okay. And this is the okay. Good. Okay, we'll go ahead and get started. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the session on ovarian cancer response followed by relapse. When will we shift the paradigm? I'd like to introduce the panel, and then I just have three introductory slides before we get into the key questions. My name is Laura Shaver, and I'm CEO of Cleave Biosciences and founder of the Clarity Foundation. The Clarity Foundation's main goal is to bring molecular profiling to the forefront of ovarian cancer diagnosis and treatment. We haven't been around for that long. We're coming up on the four-year mark, but we've kind of gone from a rebel organization on the fringes to fairly mainstream. We were preaching molecular profiling long before it became popular. And, of course, as we think about ovarian cancer and the number of actual subsets. Neil Rosen talked yesterday about it being cancer being 800 diseases, and I think they're all represented in ovarian cancer. To my left is Dr. Bob Bast from MD Anderson. Bob has been studying ovarian cancer for a long, long time and is a clinician, but also has a laboratory where he's focused on cell growth and regulation of ovarian cancer. He has a big effort in early detection and prevention. His lab also has a big effort in autophagy and tumor dormancy, as well as in the modulation of taxane sensitivity. To his left is Doug Levine from Memorial Sloan Kettering. Doug is a surgeon by training, and you may know that an independent prognostic indicator for how well you will do if you are an ovarian cancer patient is how good your surgeon is. And, in fact, I'm probably standing here today because of my surgeon, and we want them to be as aggressive as possible and get it all out, because a chemotherapy, while initially very effective, we have very, very low cure rates in ovarian cancer. Doug also has a laboratory focusing on molecular subsets. He's very, very involved in the Cancer Genome Atlas Project and heads up the ovarian cancer working group as well as the endometrial working group. To his left is Gert Kolvenbag, who is at AstraZeneca. He has been doing clinical trials in many different cancers for a long, long time, and has been doing not only innovative clinical trial designs in phase one and phase two, but also knows a lot about getting the drugs over the finish line, and has done been responsible for phase three clinical trials. And he is the product leader for olaparib, and recently probably took some heat when it was announced that they were stopping the trial in ovarian cancer for maintenance. I know I got a lot of phone calls from patients that felt that olaparib was really helping them, and could we please do something so that they could stay on that drug. So we are going to have a very interactive discussion today. We want a lot of input from and a lot of questions from the audience, but we thought as a panel that maybe not all of you would know where we are out of the gate in terms of ovarian cancer today. Unlike what we just heard with multiple myeloma and what we heard last night with APL, we have very, very low cure rates for ovarian cancer. And, in fact, although the five-year survival rate has increased, overall survival has not changed since the 1960s. So we actually have a long way to go. There's not as many of us diagnosed every year, but the percent of women that die out of the percent that are diagnosed is quite high, 15,000 out of about 22,000 diagnosed. Unfortunately, most women are diagnosed in late stage. Almost everybody has a response to standard of care, which is a platinum taxane combination. Right now, that's typically carboplatin and paclitaxel. But nevertheless, most people do respond, about half very quickly within 2 years. And then when you recur with ovarian cancer, it's really a death sentence, and you go from chemo to chemo to chemo to chemo, and oftentimes get a lot of toxicity without benefit. This is straight from the NCCN guidelines, just to show you that there's actually a lot of options when you have recurrent ovarian cancer. They're all listed here. I'm not going to read this slide, but right now the way to select the best treatment when you have recurrent disease is well, to pick out of a hat, because the GOG did a study where they looked at all these combinations and some big five-arm study, I think it was, and they all turned out to be the same. Of course, if you don't respond to platinum in the first-line setting, then you even have a more difficult time with the disease. But you can see not only in terms of the preferred agencies that are actually approved for recurrent disease, but there's a lot of other potentially active agents that are used in ovarian cancer, oftentimes after they've failed all the other ones. We certainly think that these should be moved ahead, but we really don't have the appropriate mechanisms to match patients with treatment. So here's the slide that shows, this is from Dr. Levine, this is a slide that shows how heterogeneous ovarian cancer is, which is on the bottom compared to some of the other cancers, and looking at amplifications and deletions across the genome. And you can see the contrast if you look at GBM on the top compared to ovarian cancer on the bottom, that unlike certain cancers where you can identify hot spots, we simply can't do that in ovarian cancer, and it makes our jobs so much more difficult. So if in fact there are genomic alterations in almost every chromosome, you know, how are we going to segment the population for development, ultimately treatment? How are we going to incentivize the industry to really go after these subsets when, if they have to screen 1,000 patients to get 50 for a clinical trial, we understand how difficult and costly that is. And should we just give up and put all of our money back into early detection and prevention? These are some of the key questions that we want to address today, and also welcome other questions from the audience. So I think we'll start with Doug to address the first question about how do we segment the population for the development and of drugs and ultimately treatment.
Good morning. Thank you, Laura, for the opening comments and introduction, and thank you for the invitation to be here today. I'll just spend a minute or two commenting on the disease and then go into the question that you posed. So Laura sort of presented a little bit of a dismal picture in that, you know, some people can be cured, and then when you recur, you're in trouble. And I agree with her. I'll present a little more of a positive picture in that, unfortunately, most ovarian cancer presents at an advanced stage, which is very unfortunate, where cure is low. However, survival is pretty good. In major academic centers, people can survive 5 years on average. There's two remarkable things about the disease that I like to emphasize to sort of a mixed audience. One, unlike other solid tumors, this disease stays in the abdomen. So patients present with disease all throughout the abdomen, which is very unfortunate, but it stays there. It doesn't go to the bones, doesn't really spread to distant sites hematologically. Brain metastases are extremely rare. And so there's something unique about this disease that makes it confined to the abdomen. And the good thing is that if you look at almost every other solid tumor, with rare exception, particularly abdominal solid tumors, you can't find a single other solid tumor that presents widely metastatic throughout the abdomen, and you can have a complete response to initial therapy, and you can live for years. Again, we're not curing a huge amount of patients, but it's quite remarkable that platinums works as well as they do. Nearly 80% will have a complete response to a combined treatment of surgery followed by chemotherapy. Those are two remarkable points I'd like to mention, which I think is good, which is why ovarian cancer is an attractive disease to treat, and it seemed like we should be making more progress because so much progress was made with platinums 2 decades ago. So in the background of that, more recent understanding that we have, as was mentioned, is that ovary cancer is not one disease, and the easiest way to initially subset ovarian cancer is under the microscope. And oftentimes we forget about that. And when we speak of ovary cancer that's lethal, we're typically speaking of high-grade serous ovarian cancer, which really only accounts for about 60% of the entire disease. This is advanced high-grade serous ovarian cancer. Like any other cancer, we're doing pretty well curing stage 1 disease. That's not so hard. But we have other types of ovarian cancer. We have low-grade serous tumors, we have non-serous tumors, and then we have the less common non-epithelial tumors. And that's the easiest way to subset the disease. And many of our cooperative group clinical trials now are subsetting the diseases that way, and we probably should do that more. And in various phase trials, we also should make sure that we're choosing the right disease to study, because there's the first problem is if you lump all types of cancers together and call them ovarian cancer. Something we may want to talk about later is the fact that ovary cancer may not even come from the ovary, but that's not the question at the moment. So if you look at high-grade serous ovarian cancer, there's many common features, of course. They almost all universally have a P53 mutation. Many of them have defects in the homologous recombination pathway, which we may discuss later. And so what we've learned from, I'd say, genomic studies in the past 5 years is that you can subset high-grade serous cancer into a number of subgroups, primarily based on gene expression. What we've learned more recently is that there is actually overlap within these subsets. And so it's not that each tumor is clearly defined. There is some overlap. And even more recently, you'll probably hear in the next 6 months or so, that what you see at diagnosis is not what you get when the tumors recur. And so if you want to talk about subsetting the disease, the most important subset to start with is primary versus recurrent disease. Recurrent disease has been under selection of platinum agents, and it's going to look completely different than primary disease. Almost all of our genomic studies, we study primary disease because that's what we have available. It gets removed. They're giant tumors. They're great to study. Laboratory scientists love them because there's tons of material to work with. When cancers recur, we have less material to work with. We do have some, but people aren't typically doing the same studies on recurrent disease, and that's really where all the drugs are coming in the recurrent setting, and so we probably need to learn more about the recurrent setting. We have a lot of targets. Again, the treatment is not, again, I'll disagree with Laura, the treatment's not so much pick it out of a hat. If you have your first recurrence, the best treatment is more platinum, and we give that to everybody routinely. So that's very well defined, that if you're platinum sensitive, you get more platinum. Now you get it with a second agent that may be slightly less important than the platinum agent. Once you develop platinum-resistant disease, then we have a number of drugs that do not work very well, and we don't really in clinical practice pick them out of the hat. They may have equally low efficacy. We do pick them out based on individual patient characteristics, toxicities, quality of life issues, but not certainly the issue of which drug works the best, which we would like to do, and we probably can do that in the future. So let me stop there, and I can make more comments later if appropriate.
Doug had mentioned that you can subset all ovarian cancers into low-grade and high-grade, and that turns out to be true at the molecular level as well. The low-grade cancers are about 10 or 20% of the ovarian cancers overall, and they're probably our most proximal target with targeted therapy at the present time because they have activating mutations. Most of the high-grade serous have inactivating mutations, often of BRCA1 or 2, about 40%, and P53 in virtually every cancer. But they have very few activating mutations in the garden variety high-grade cancers. They do have amplification, and there are at least 20 amplified targets for which drugs are currently available for ovarian cancer. Low-grade is a proximal target because you can detect mutations to RAS and RAF. Also, a fraction of them have estrogen receptor signaling still intact, so that you can use estrogen receptor inhibitors. Also, P53 is almost universally intact, so you can think about Nutlin-like drugs that inhibit MDM-P53 interactions. The challenge is getting enough patients together, and David Gershenson and others have put together a committee, at least to the gynecologic oncology group, to start to look systematically at low-grade cancers. In terms of the high grades, they break down into about 40 to 50% that have BRCA deficiency, not necessarily germline mutation. No, that's only about 10 or 15% of that 40 or 50%, and PI3 kinase. And one of the things that really needs to be done sooner than later in high-grade cancers is to look at a combination of PARP inhibitors with PI3 kinase inhibitors, and perhaps I could turn that over to Gert to comment on how we're going to do that trial.
And maybe you could also comment then on the challenges about getting biopsies in your clinical trial, because Doug mentioned how the recurrent specimens are different than primary, and actually we just published a paper on that in Molecular Cancer Therapeutics with matched samples. So maybe you could comment on the challenges of the biopsy in the clinical trial setting.
Well, I have a whole list of questions to address. So my experience in ovarian cancer is the development of olaparib. I've been working on it for 3 years, trying to progress this through the regulatory hurdles, looking at reimbursement hurdles, and in particular, most effort trying to get it to the patient, because it is an active drug. And I think we all agree on that. But the challenges to get it on the market are enormous. I think the four things that any drug needs for the olaparib as well is, you know, you need to have a dose schedule and a dose. You need to have an indication and then be able to identify your patients. And an indication that needs to lead to regulatory approval and reimbursement, because without reimbursement, there's no incentive for anybody to use the drug. And then lastly, the business proposal needs to be attractive as well. So all those factors play, and I call it the microenvironment. We talk a lot about macro environment. We talk a lot about micro environment. This is the macro environment we live in as well. Talking about patient selection, olaparib is a PARP inhibitor, which is effective in patients who have a DNA repair deficiency, also called HRD. And BRCA mutations are a big part of that. But a BRCA mutation is not an on and off black and white situation. It's a gradual effect. Some mutations are very sensitive, some others are less sensitive. So it's a tool that we can use, but it's not the ultimate tool. So we've been looking at how can we select patients, and we looked at genetic signatures and all kind of factors in parallel to the drug development. And in absence of a signature, any definite tool to use, we use very empirical, obvious signals, and by looking at patient populations like high-grade serous ovarian cancer, we select on that. And then we also looked at a response to platinum as a surrogate for double-stranded DNA repair, because the way the cell deals with platinum damage, one of the three ways, overlaps with the double-strand DNA repair that we need for a PARP inhibitor to be effective. And so in our phase 2 trial, we did show actually a very encouraging PFS result with a hazard ratio of 0.35, which was fantastic, and we were all gearing up for the phase 3 to get started. But in talking in our macro environment to regulators, to our payers, and to our users in the marketplace, it came back to us that the overall survival endpoint was the key endpoint for any success of this drug, and that PFS by itself was not going to be sufficient. So before we started our phase 3 program, we looked in our phase 2 trial overall survival, and lo and behold, there's no overall survival benefit. The hazard ratio was 0.94, extremely disappointing. And so the probability for a successful phase 3 program was close to nil. It was 8%, which is an enormous challenge. So we said, well, is there? That's what we're doing right now. So we did not progress in phase 3. That's the statement we made. And what we are doing right now is there in this group where we looked at selection on histology and platinum response, is there a way to select the patient group that there maybe is a survival benefit in there? And that's currently ongoing. And are there any other ways of developing this drug?
So maybe, I don't know if this microphone is on, but one last slide for you to comment on. I'm usually famous for throwing in surprise slides, but in this case I didn't do it, Doug did it, which is the slide on looking at DNA repair deficiencies and how to subset these. And
you know, the question would be, is it worth in for the development of a olaparib to subset by patients that have some of these deficiencies in HR repair versus those that do not? And are you able to get biopsies so that you can look at these types of alterations?
Yeah, so we do have biopsies, and we currently are fully exploring whether what we have and how this relates to the survival endpoint. That's currently ongoing. For years I've been asking, anybody who has an HRD diagnostic, please call me. I haven't had any call. Somebody answer. There's parts in there we can diagnose. I mean, there's individual factors we can identify, but then you miss out some others that potentially could benefit. So it's difficult to pick just one factor if you know there's others that are. With regard to biopsies, I think in general, and this is another topic that is dear to my heart, I think in general it's very hard to get biopsies in clinical trials. First of all, in the bigger picture, I think it's very hard to get patients in clinical trials. Only about 5% of cancer patients are going into clinical trials, which is extremely disappointing if we say we have so much new drugs coming down the pathway. You know, why are not more patients being enrolled in clinical trials? And it's a call to the entire community to increase that. And then in biopsies, I think in general, it's about 35% of patients you can get biopsies from in general in clinical trials. I know there's better practices and there's centers of excellence where you can get close to 80 or 90%, sometimes even 100% of patients with samples. But in general, it's about 35% of the larger trials. So that's the initial biopsy, let alone paired biopsies on the relapse. We would have loved to have biopsies on relapse in order to explain what happens between PFS and OS. What happened? Has the disease changed? Because that's a question we don't know. Because we treated as maintenance, what do you do as a maintenance therapy?
I think those are excellent questions. I think it probably has changed. We probably do need to, as patients consent to biopsies and physicians need to want to get them for us. But it does bring up the next question that the next key question that we had on our list, and then we'll open it up for some audience questions, is, well, are we paying enough? Are we putting enough emphasis on early detection and prevention? Prevention either from the get-go or prevention in a recurrent setting? And I'd like to ask Dr. Bass to comment on that.
With regard to prevention, there is a preventive agent that's been available for the last 40 or 50 years, and that's oral contraceptives. One of the best-kept secrets in the gynecologic community is that 5 years of taking oral contraceptives cuts by half the risk for ovarian cancer in later life. Not clear exactly why that's the case. When we were using high doses of estrogen and progesterone for oral contraception, you may suppress ovulation with less wear and tear on the ovary and consequently less of a risk of spontaneous mutation. With the lower doses of progesterone and estrogen, it may be the progesterone that's purging premalignant cells. At least that's one of the theories. It's difficult to know who is at sufficient risk at the present time, aside from patients with BRCA1 and BRCA2, to specifically prescribe oral contraceptives for prevention, and it's a very long-term study. One other approach that Olya Finn has pioneered at University of Pittsburgh is using MUC1 vaccines to prevent breast cancer and, oh, by the way, ovarian cancer. Which is, and if you can imagine bundling preventive strategies for breast cancer that would also apply to ovarian cancer, a much less common disease, where the lifelong risk is 1 in 70 as opposed to 1 in 8 or 9, that's another possibility to consider. I think with early detection, the jury is out. And there's some very promising data from the UK. Usha Menon and Ian Jacobs at University College London have a huge 200,000-woman study that you could only do in the UK, where 100,000 are getting routine pelvic exams each year, 50,000 are getting ultrasound each year, and then 50,000 are getting CA125 each year, but monitored sequentially. And that's extraordinarily important. And yesterday we heard a lot about dose and schedule and how you use a drug In the case of CA125, it's how you use the biomarker. Because if you actually use each woman as her own baseline in a Bayesian approach and change point analysis, you can get a much more specific test than you need a specific test. Ovarian cancer is neither common nor a rare disease. It's somewhere in between. The prevalence in postmenopausal women who are at greatest risk is about 1 in 2,500. And with that, it means you need a sensitive test, as you'd expect for early detection, but you need a very specific test, 99.6% specificity, in order to be able to actually not alarm a lot of women, run up a lot of unnecessary tests, and perhaps even unnecessary operations. CA125 is a single one-off test. Doesn't do that. It's 99% specific, but it's not 99.6% specific. If you use, however, sequential CA125 and just do ultrasounds on those individuals who have a rising CA125 and then do surgery based on those ultrasounds, you only do three operations for each case of ovarian cancer detected. And in contrast to the prostate, lung, colon, and ovary study in this country where they did things one-off, in the UK study, they're seeing a stage shift. Laura had mentioned that 20 or 25% of patients currently are detected in early stage. In the UK, almost half of the women were detected in the first 2 or 3 years in early stage. We've been doing a micro version of the study in the UK through the specific specialized programs of research excellence, or the SPORE grants that Ken was mentioning. We have a SPORE at ovarian cancer, in ovarian cancer at MD Anderson. We've got six sites around the country where we've studied about 4,000 women as opposed to 200,000. But even with that, we've been able to show that you have three operations for each case of ovarian cancer detected. We've done 10 operations, and we've had six patients all in early stage. Two of those were borderline and arguably might not have progressed rapidly, but four were high-grade serous in stage one or stage two, suggesting that CA125 may be sensitive enough if you can use that in a sequential manner. I think that clearly there's room for improvement, and we've looked at almost 100 biomarkers to complement CA125. We found three that do that. We've been working with John McDevitt at Rice to put those on a nano platform. Our vision is if the UK trial, which will turn out in 2015, turns out to be positive, you could imagine screening clinics all over the United States, the FDA willing, where you could walk in, get a finger stick rather than a blood draw, have a drop of blood assayed within 30 to 45 minutes, and either get an ultrasound right then and there or come back in a year. And so this is, I think, the strategy of the future. That we know, though, that CA125 is the first step's not going to be adequate. You're going to miss 20% of the cancers right off because 20% of ovarian cancers don't express enough CA125 to be detected. So we've found three other biomarkers that on the nano platform. We're also going a step further than that. And with Origine, and you heard from Wei Wu Hu last night about the Origine Chinese-American collaboration. Given that incredible organization, we've been able to look once again at autoantibodies in a little different way. People do make antibodies against their cancer cells and human proteins associated with those. But with Origine, it's been possible to express more than 10,500 human proteins in human cells. People have done this in bacteria before and insect cells. But if you're looking for epitopes and antigens, it makes a huge difference how the proteins fold, how they're glycosylated. And in this way, you can actually get human epitopes. And we found about 150 antibodies, some of which have been described before at Sloan Kettering and other spots, give us an idea that we're on the right track. We're currently looking at whether you could detect much smaller tumors with the autoantibody response over time than just with antigens alone. One thing that's helped hugely, though, is we've support from the National Foundation for Cancer Research. We've been able to work with Ed Flynn in New Mexico, who's got a small startup with a senior scientific in Manhattan Scientific that is using the SQID technology to look at the second step. If CA125 or antigens or antibodies are in the first step, currently we're using ultrasound, which is a crude tool that can't even see fallopian tube tumors, for the second step. And Ed Flynn has developed a technique called SQUID. It's a quantum interference technique that's incredibly sensitive. And he uses antibodies with ferritin particles, and if these orient on the surface of ovarian cancer cells, you can get a signal. And it turns out that, you, at least in Ed's preliminary experiments, you can detect 10 to the 5th ovarian cancer cells. That's four orders of magnitude below what you can detect with ultrasound. And so thanks to the NFCR, we're going to be able to test that, be sure that's right, and to see if we can find better antibodies that actually detect ovarian cancers and distinguish them from fallopian tube and some of the other things that might affect the sensitivity. So I don't think it's time to give up on early detection. If the trial in the UK is positive, and we'll know that in the next 2 to 3 years, that we may have a strategy that actually works on which we can build.
I want to make just one comment, going back one speaker here. I just want to comment regarding the biopsies and disagree a little bit. If you look at a few studies that have been done asking doctors versus patients whether they will agree to have a biopsy, the patients are always much more willing to be consented to have a biopsy. And my opinion, not being in the drug development world too much, is that a lot of money goes into finding lead targets, developing drugs, and running these trials. The amount of additional money it costs to get specimens and do correlative science has to be tiny compared to the amount of money that it's taken to get to that point already. And if you collected specimens, whether you use them or not, obviously you need some sort of response rate to learn something. But if you collect the specimens in the beginning, when you have those response rates, even if it's a 5 or 10% response rate, now we're probably pretty well poised to figure out why it is that 10% is responding. If you have a 10% response rate and then want to go on and then figure that out later, that may not be on the business agenda. But I really think that patients are happy to do biopsies. That definitely at academic centers, we're quite good at getting them, and we now have technologies that we can do a lot and learn a lot from very small specimens.
Just see if there's any questions from the audience. Okay, we have one in the back here.
I'm curious about the commercial and regulatory feedback you got on endpoint for ovarian, and whether that was specific to the platinum sensitive group or whether the overall survival endpoint is really going to be required across categories, resistant, refractory. Any sense of that?
So what is your question precisely?
My question is that was your statement that overall survival would be required in platinum-sensitive ovarian cancer, or is it more broadly applied to platinum-resistant and platinum-refractory, or would PFS serve in those categories? Do you have a sense for that?
The question we asked to our macro environment was about our development program. So it is specific for our patient population with platinum-sensitive ovarian cancer. Does it apply to other settings? It may well be, but I think.
We do a lot of interacting with industry that has drugs in clinical trials, and I think that the regulators are asking for overall survival across the population, platinum-sensitive, platinum-resistant, because their view is that that is now the gold standard, and while the treatment options aren't good and that the sensitivity is low, there are options, and so they are looking for something that's better than what exists today. It's a big, big problem because particularly in platinum-sensitive disease, the ovarian cancer patients tend to live a long time. So if you want to do a study in platinum-sensitive ovarian cancer, you have to wait a long time to reach your endpoints, and that makes it, you know, when you're a drug company that has options about where you're going to develop your agent, it's one of the reasons that ovarian cancer doesn't bubble to the top. That and the fact that they're hard to enroll. And then if you're going to try to subset on top of that, it even makes it harder to enroll.
One thing to add there is that we were looking at a maintenance setting, and I think there is something about a maintenance setting because it's relatively new to get something in that space. And so you can delay progression, but you don't know what you're doing to the disease later on. So for that measurement, you can say the most unbiased measurement is overall survival.
And in the platinum resistance setting, of course, people would be much more happy to go on trials because the drugs work so much worse that we currently have available, but that's a much more challenging area to get an effective agent. It's also an area where we know very little about the disease. At that point, it's probably very different and very heterogeneous. So, but that's certainly an area where we could learn a lot and where most drugs will be entering, and you could see a difference much quicker if there was an effective agent.
So I guess maybe one more point. Before I... interested in whether there, whether there's any interest in intraperitoneal therapies if they are, if they're providing some unique advantage. So, for example, in the realm of RNA interference, if that were an effective way to deliver against targets that would otherwise be undruggable, is that something that's feasible in this day and age? I know that there have been trials in the past, but not too much that's active now.
Yeah, that's a spectacular question, and I think it's very feasible. You know, just for the rest of the group, we've been doing IP therapy at probably both of our centers for about 20 years, and that's now been moved into the upfront setting. Obviously, IP therapies work when there's generally a small volume disease, unless there's an amazing agent that's going to work for large volume disease. So the thing you're talking about, I would envision it's going to work in either the consolidation setting or the remission setting. We have a lot of experience with it, so to stick an active agent in there will be very promising. We have vaccines we're working on now that are being tested intraperitoneally in the lab. Obviously, any initial trial is going to be expensive because now you're not only talking about a biopsy, you're talking about some type of interventional or surgical procedure. But ovarian cancer patients and doctors are well familiar with that, and I think that would be very, very attractive.
Bob, the data with the fallopian tube origin, is that likely now? Is it holding up? And has it given you any opportunity to see earlier lesions because it is in the tubes?
I think for those of you who don't work with ovarian cancer every day, it's important to realize that in normal physiology, the fallopian tubes actually hover over the ovary, and the fimbria or fingers of the fallopian tube actually cover the ovary so that the ovum at ovulation can get into the fallopian tube where it can be fertilized. Over the last 5 to 10 years, it's become apparent that perhaps up to 80% of the familial BRCA1, BRCA2 germline mutation carrier-derived ovarian cancers may come from the fallopian tube rather than from the ovary. We've known for years that about 20% of all the patients who walk in the door, at least at MD Anderson, have had primary peritoneal cancer. It looks just like ovarian cancer, high-grade serous tumors, but it covers or coats the ovary rather than grows out of the ovary. And it's very likely that the fallopian tube might be the source of that 20%. These fimbria of the fallopian tube are just there in the peritoneal cavity, and it's been possible to show premalignant lesions. Chris Crum and others at the Brigham have described that over the years. As soon as cells become malignant, they could slough off and get into the peritoneal cavity. The real enthusiasts, I think, are pushing that all ovarian cancers are coming from the fallopian tube. I don't personally believe that. But I think certainly the majority of familial cases, which is about 15% of all the ovarian cancers, and probably about 20% of the sporadic cases could well come from the tube. And that places constraints certainly on our ability to detect the disease because the ultrasounds are largely blind to any fallopian tube lesions. There's no anatomic barrier, so at the very earliest stages, the disease could spread. So we need very sensitive techniques, perhaps like SQUID, to be able to pick those things up imaging-wise, and much more sensitive techniques for the first stage of a two-stage screening strategy. Antibodies held the hope for that, but it has to be demonstrated where you can get an amplification, where a very little tumor could stimulate an awful lot of antibody.
I wanted to follow up on a biomarker potentially for PARP inhibitors. So, Geert, you mentioned an HR diagnostic. We seem to have been circling around this space for 3, 4, 5 years. Myriad supposedly now has a genomic instability signature. Other people have been looking at the MIP assays. Bob, you mentioned last evening Gordon Mills may have something in this kind of BRCA-ness space. We seem to be circling around it, but not quite getting there. What's stopping us?
Well, first of all, I'll just comment and then turn it over to the other panel members. But as you say, there are there are now diagnostic companies that are launching BRCA panels. So some of these that deal with amplifications, mutations, deletions can be detected by the Foundation Medicine panel. Althea Diagnostic has just launched, although they haven't publicly announced it, their BRCA panel, which is a I think an 18 gene panel, all in the HR pathway, so things like RAD51, FANCD, we do need the diagnostic labs to step up. But the problem is that there's not enough experience yet to establish what the cut points are. If you're looking at expression, how much expression do you want? If you're looking at amplification, how much amplification is significant? We run into this with HER2, where, you know, twofold amplification did not result in sensitivity to Herceptin like it does with breast cancer. But we have some patients in our database that are 12-fold amplified for HER2, and nobody did that clinical trial because it was one out of 200, and you have to screen so much to get that number. So we're faced with the same situation now with the BRCA panels that we have to, one, we need the assays, but we need to get the experience. So, Gert, do you have any, want to add to that?
Yeah. I think we are indeed circling, and we must be close, but we don't know how close we are. When we had the progression-free survival result about a year ago, we did explore quite extensively if there was one of the signatures available that would help us in predicting patients. And we used the three most leading signatures. One we developed ourselves and two from external partners. And beyond the high-grade and platinum sensitivity of platinum responders, that was the best selection criteria. The signatures could not select better than the histology and the platinum response. We are in contact with some other companies that are now claiming to have a BRCA-ness test to see if that would help us in our effort to get olaparib forward. But that's currently ongoing.
Tissues available from your phase 2 trials and from Joyce O'Shaughnessy's phase 3?
Yeah, we have tissue again, but we have initial tissue. We don't have tissue on recurrence, which in hindsight we would love to have. Yes. Had, but we have tissue from the phase 2 trial. Yeah.
Let me just interject a word of caution about these markers. Having participated in some of the developments of these signatures, you know, it really all comes down to validation. You know, every paper that gets reported nowadays is one or two levels of really validation within that, you know, publication. But you really need a completely independent group to validate the signatures. We know those often fail, and that's genomic signatures. Other, DNA mutation, I think we're pretty good at. The other type of panels you might see, of course, are IHC markers, and IHC is a great tool. But so many times I find that there'll be a marker commercially available or by a diagnostic lab, and you ask them how they validated that marker, and it really falls short of what will be done in a more rigorous environment. For example, Myriad recently been advertising a P10 IHC, and we tried to work with them and tried to get some samples that could be run and tried to get copies of the images so we could look at them independently, and they weren't available. So all of these tests, really, you got to make sure how they're validated. They're validated against rigorous controls, so you know that the result you're getting is something that is going to be worthwhile.
The overall survival data for olaparib was indeed very surprising. And if I recall correctly from some of the early clinical data, olaparib was able to induce responses in patients irrespective of BRCA status, and had activity as a single agent. This is in contrast to other inhibitors of the class, which really only work in combination with chemotherapy. So could you comment on what makes olaparib unique and what sort of selection criteria or biomarkers you might be pursuing?
I think most of the other PARP inhibitors didn't actually try to establish monotherapy activity, so that I don't know how active they are. One leading agent in the class later on turned out to be not a PARP inhibitor. And the whole class is struggling with how to combine best with chemotherapy, mainly because of toxicity. So I think none of the PARP inhibitors have established a regimen that is tolerated and effective in combination setting. So as a monotherapy, the best way we thought it would develop was selecting patients on histology and response to platinum. And in serious rare maintenance, that is not a way forward. How to select them better, that's something that we're currently looking at, either in that population or in another population. And that all is to be determined what is the best way forward. So I cannot answer your question other than there's still work ongoing to establish how to select patients best for a PARP inhibitor. But it's not easy.
Thank you. So I would just like to ask one more question of the panel before we wrap up. Yesterday, on the clinical trials panel and the innovative trial designs, they were talking about how to have clinical trials that where decisions were made in days, such that if the therapy did not work, you would go on to something else, and you would only stay on if there were signs that it was working. And in ovarian cancer, and we also heard yesterday the comment about putting the patient first, which I quite like. And so often in ovarian cancer, we hear that, please stay on this for three cycles, even though your CA-125 is rising. When is that going to end? When are we going to be more creative for the patient and continue to give them toxicity without benefit?
A great question. In terms of the biomarkers that we use for monitoring patients with ovarian cancer, there are at least two that are federally FDA approved at the present time. CA-125, of course, has been around for a while. But HE4 has been described more recently for monitoring. And I think with CA-125, you can sometimes see a blip of activity with a dramatic response to chemotherapy, so that you can see a small transient rise in CA-125. But I think a persistent increase over time, over 2 to 4 weeks or 6 weeks, at multiple determinations, at least a 50% increase, is pretty solid indication that you've got disease progression. It's been suggested that in drug development, if you really believed in biomarkers, you could take those as a rising CA-125 as evidence of failure of your compound, and consequently you could enroll many people who didn't necessarily meet RECIST criteria if you were willing to believe in that. And obviously with each one of the targeted therapies, it's always possible that you might change the shedding of a biomarker like CA-125 or its clearance. But I think with the advantage of the PET CT scans in GIST, for example, is that if you hit the PI3 kinase pathway and that affects GLUT1 and you can't take up glucose within 24 or 48 hours, you really can get very early indications that really could trump both the biomarkers and also the CT scans over time. I think with GIST, it's really dramatic. You can see a change in the PET scan within 48 hours. It takes 4 to 6 months to see the subsequent regressions. In ovarian cancer, I don't think we have many examples of that yet. We need much more active targeted therapy to really be able to test that possibility.
Thank you.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good question. I don't think those studies really have been done. They could be done. I have to say that with some chemotherapy agents, particularly Doxil and now other biologics, you may not be able to do that because the response may not be immediate. You may need, it may be a delayed response. And so if you actually looked at an early biomarker, and we see this in other solid tumors as well, if you look at an early biomarker and declare there's no response, you might actually be removing inhibition that would 3 months later result in quite a impressive response. And so it's definitely a...
So how do we set guidelines for those patients that yesterday we heard about, also about the anti-angiogenics and why it was perhaps necessary to treat through progression? So how do we set guidelines for when to treat through progression versus switching to a drug that may have a higher likelihood to benefit?
right. Well, that leads to a nice concluding comment for me that I think, as we heard in the first keynote address, that collaboration is really, you know, important. I think there's so many subtleties to every clinical trial, picking the right patients, doing the right science, obviously dose and schedule, that you really need the collaboration between academia, disease experts, you know, and industry together so that you're not just, you know, setting up for a trial that's almost destined to fail because you thought that you need to get the patients accrued quickly, when in fact you accrued the wrong type of patients and you failed for that reason.
Thank you. Gert?
Yeah, I'll ask in very general terms and say, well, in order to make those decisions, you need to ask the right question, generate data, and draw the conclusion. So.
Okay, I think our hour's up, so we'll stop. Thank you.